to Authors Like Us.
Right. Calling Sarah Prineas.
Let's make it work.
I'm wearing a Rick Riordan shirt. I was wondering if I should have changed that.
Where did you get a Rick Riordan shirt from?
The publisher gave it away.
Oh.
I'm a total shill.
You like the swag?
Yep. It's a free shirt.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
I am well. Hang on one second.
Sure. Okay.
That should do it.
Hit that accept button.
Okay, good. All right. Little light went on that showed that my video's working. Cool.
Excellent. Oh, cool. There you are.
There. Here we are.
Hi.
Welcome to Authors Like Us,
the big show. It's real thrilled to have you on the show. I've been teaching your book all last year. So I have my dog-eared copy here. So I was really excited when James told me he had connected with you.
Cool. How old are your students?
We both teach in a creative writing class, so it's beyond the school system. So anywhere from age 8 to, I don't know, you teach older.
17.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I've been teaching mine to your book to middle grade, so. Real big fan. I love it. Haven't read the sequel yet, but that's my life as a teacher. I only ever get to read the first book of any series, then I gotta move on.
The students read the rest, though. The students do.
Yeah, I hope so. Anyway,
yeah.
So, Lee, you're a writer too?
Yes, we're both authors. I'm an author illustrator. I've one up on James.
Okay. Yeah, no, I knew James was an author because we're friends on Facebook, so I've kind of been aware of, but I didn't know what your role was exactly. So cool. So what's your book?
Well, we're here to talk about you.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Our listeners know all about our sad stories, so you know we're here to introduce you.
We're very curious about this dragon collection that we've read about.
Yeah. What do you want to know?
Well, I'm looking around, trying to look over your shoulder. I don't see any dragons. So are they in this room?
They're not. Well, there's one in this room, and it's on my arm because I have a tattoo of a dragon.
Oh, cool.
Wow.
But I'm not going to show it to you.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Just to be clear.
Right. The dragons are in the other room in my office, which I never use to actually write in or do anything in.
You keep your dragons there.
Yeah, I keep them there in my dragon room, really. And a lot of them are packed away because I have this cat who is just a predator of my dragon collection. So she has mangled several of them. And so.
Really?
She broke. I had a glass one that she broke, and I had a kind of a Christmas ornament one that she gnawed. And I had another rubber one. She gnawed the horns off it.
She's so very threatened by these dragons.
I think you have a story idea there.
Probably.
The cat who hunts dragons.
Yes, right. Yeah, she's pretty fierce.
So where does the love of dragons come from? Has that been a long time fascination, or is that something relatively new?
Well, long time. I guess since I became a fantasy reader, which was not, I wasn't really as a kid, well, a little bit, but not like a huge fangirl the way I am now, probably in the last 10 years or so. I've gotten interested in them. And the reason I like dragons is because if you think about dragons and their physiology, the way they're constructed, if you look at them aerodynamically, they should not be able to fly. Because if you think about the musculature, like they would need a keel bone that would extend out like 15 feet in order to anchor the muscles that would power their wings. So they shouldn't be able to fly, but they can. And it's magic. And that's why I like them, is because there's something that shouldn't be airborne, and yet they are. And that's, for me, I see that as a metaphor for fiction. Like somehow your fiction flies and you're never really sure how it happens and where the musculature is actually anchored, but it works. And so that's why I love dragons.
Or when your fiction is going to crash.
Exactly. Well, you don't know why. How does this work exactly? It's not something you can put your finger on.
That's a great metaphor.
Yeah, I really like that. There's so much material here now, and there's so many questions to have. So were you always a writer then as a kid? And were you writing things other than fantasy?
I wrote a little as a kid, mostly poetry. But I was a passionate reader, and I read everything. And I read, like, the books that I loved, I read repeatedly over and over again. One of the things, though, that I'm discovering, I do a lot of Skype visits with students in schools, and I also do a lot of school visits, too. But one of the things I'm realizing is when I was a kid, I never met an author. And it never occurred to me that actual living human people had written the books that I love. And so it didn't occur to me that I could write either. And so it took me until I was in my 30s to start writing. And I wonder sometimes, like, if I'd ever had that moment where an author came to my school or signed a book that I'd read, where I'd gone, oh, wow, like, I could do this too. So, I haven't always been a writer. But I wonder sometimes what would have happened, like how my life would have been different if I'd started earlier instead of, you know, I had this whole other career first and then started writing.
So you wish you started earlier?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
And you started writing for adults first.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was writing science fiction and fantasy short stories, kind of like an apprenticeship. And I look back on that, and the intention was that they were always adult stories, and the venues they were published in were generally adult venues, you know, magazines and so on. But I look back at those stories, and I realize that a lot of the sensibility in those stories is more like YA and middle grade sensibility. And I think all along, that's what I was writing. It's just, I finally really found my register and my voice in the Magic Thief books and settled into really determinedly writing middle grade instead of whatever else I was doing.
Yeah, that's interesting because we both write fantasy books, but I actually don't really read fantasy books that are written for an adult audience. I'm kind of mired in the middle grade world as well. And I don't know, it seems more fun in a lot of ways.
It is.
You know,
it
it's
is.
More, I like the whimsy, I guess. I like the fun of it. And I think sometimes in fantasy writing for adults, it gets sucked away somehow or becomes so serious.
And I don't know if you find this too, but when you're writing for a younger audience, you have to capture them right away. You can't have anything in the beginning that's going to lose their interest because they are a very discerning audience.
Yeah, and it is. It's storytelling really pared down to the essence of story. And it's the same thing. That's why I love it. Because you hit the ground running and you can't waste any time. It's good stuff. I like it.
And are you working on another Magic Thief book now?
I get that question a lot. So there are three books out. And my publisher took three more books from me. My next book is out in January. It's called Winterling. And it is not a Magic Thief book. Then there's the sequel to Winterling, which is called The Summerkin, which I'm just about to turn into my editor. And after that, there's that third book on the contract. And I would like very much for that to be a fourth Magic Thief book. I've actually written it. It's written. It's done.
Oh, wow.
And I get a lot of emails about it, believe me. But my publisher hasn't decided yet if that is actually going to be the third book on the contract. And there would be a gap of a couple years between the third Magic Thief book and this fourth one. And so it's kind of up to my publisher whether they want to take the book and kind of relaunch the series for a new audience. Because all of the kids that were reading it the first time around are, you know, they've aged out of it probably
by the
time the fourth one comes out. So you know, it's whether they're going to take on that as a project or not. And I won't know probably for half a year or so whether that's going to happen.
Well, you have a new book coming out for January.
Yes.
That's exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited. It's very different from The Magic Thief.
You sound very prolific. Oh, how's it different?
Well, it's not hugely different. It's still a fantasy and it's middle grade. But the main character is a girl. And it's in the third person. The Magic Thief is all first person. It's told by the main character, Conwer. And this book is in the third. I wanted to do more what I call pretty writing. So, limitations of first person are that you can really show the world as that character sees it. So Con is a very pragmatic kid. He doesn't embellish a lot on his world. He just kind of sees it for what it is. So I wanted a chance to be able to flex my dragon wings, I guess, a little bit in this book and try to do more. It's not literary, but more, use more metaphor and more description and stuff that you can't do when you're anchored to that first person.
You know, I find that really interesting that you view your work that way, because one of the reasons why I love teaching your book and one of the reasons why I have taught it so much is because of the description in it. And I often read the first chapter, and then we break down all the different literary figurative devices that you have used, right? Because you don't always see that so much. And when I'm trying to teach writing, trying to get kids to employ those techniques, and then I can show an author using it in the book we're reading. So mm-hmm. It's kind of amusing to me that you think that, because I actually, you know, love the first chapter, and there's different, like the onomatopoeia, the different, it's really strong, rich vocabulary, and I love vocabulary. So I love the fact that I could teach this book that has that texture in it. So yeah. It's just kind of interesting to me. Now I'm curious to see what this other book's going to be like.
I think with the Magic Thief, it's so tied to voice for me that it feels like that's not me being a literary writer or anything. It's just, that's the way Khan sees the world. And so I'm so closely tied to his personality and who he is and his view of the world that's what happens to end up on the page. So it's a little different with the third person for me.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. I've written three books in third person, and then one book I did in first person, which was quite a step away from how I write, because I'm used to writing in third person. I found it quite freeing almost to write in first person, just because you really get, I think you get to know the character a little bit better, but
absolutely.
I don't know if you find this, but when you're writing in third person, you're not just writing somebody's opinion of something, you're writing other people's opinions of those other people. And
the other thing that was hard, as you say, you know, you get really, in the first person, you get really close to that character. In the third, I felt it was hard for me to write Winterling at first because I felt so distanced from the character, from the main character, and it took me much longer to figure out what she wanted, what she needed, kind of what was motivating her through the story. Whereas with Khan in The Magic Thief, I never had any doubts about those things at all. It was just go, you know, and Zoo books wrote themselves, really. But yeah, third person, definitely harder for me initially to kind of get past that gap between the character and the perspective, the point of view.
Are we bringing dragons into any of these works? Because as I've already confessed, I've only read the first Magic Thief, so excuse me if there are dragons in the sequels, but it doesn't seem like a dragonish world to me.
Oh, well, in the first book, I don't know if you remember, Khan, early in the book, he goes into Nebri's study and he finds this old painting of a dragon.
Okay.
And he asks Nebri what it is, and Nebri says, oh, it's a dragon. And Khan's like, well, you know, what's a dragon? And Nebri says, oh, you'll never see a dragon, boy. They're extinct. And
okay. So there's a clue.
yeah, but Nebri's wrong.
Right.
He's wrong.
Okay.
And actually, dragons are hugely important in the third book.
Oh,
there's hints about them in the second book, but they're like the point on which everything turns.
Oh, okay.
They're very important in the third book. There are no dragons in Winterling or Summerkin. That is not a dragon world at all.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And any desire to write something other than fantasy, or?
Every now and then, yeah, maybe.
You're talking to two fantasy lovers here, so
I love, I love writing fantasy. I love the apparatus of fantasy and all the tropes. I mean, obviously, if you've read The Magic Thief, you know there are so many fantasy tropes in that book, which I use purposely because I love them so much. The wizard, the boy apprentice, the, you know,
transformation.
All that stuff. Love that stuff. There is, I think, a tendency, at least in the U.S., as teachers and librarians encounter fantasy, for them to be a little bit leery of it. I think that they don't always have the reading protocols in place for them to be able to deal with fantasy, especially secondary world fantasy. You see a lot of these portal fantasies or fantasies that occur in our world that are a little easier for those readers to get into. I don't think kid readers have any problem with it at all.
No, I don't think so
either. Teachers and librarians, though, I've seen them. They get a little bewildered when they encounter secondary world fantasy. So I think of that audience, and I think that audience is much more comfortable with realistic fiction, and especially with realistic historical fiction. If you look at last year's Newbery Award winner, for example, all of them were historical. One was poetry, but they were all historical, realistic fiction. And so I think there's this, you know, this tendency for readers to, in the U.S., especially the gatekeeper.
The gatekeepers.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? I mean, do you find that?
I think it's the same in Canada because our Governor General Award, which is kind of our big literary award, it's always realistic fiction.
Is it?
It's always the depressed kid who's going to commit suicide or go on drugs or, which is what Canadian, you know, adults seem to like in children's literature. But yeah, never
you're just in one single stroke ruining your career right now.
Yeah. Okay. I'll never win the Governor General Award because I love writing fantasy.
I'm just here. I just find it curious because I don't know. In one sense, I always think I guess I have it. I mean, I don't live in reality anyway. But I guess I'm thinking that children's librarians grew up loving children's books and loving fantasy books, and so would be very comfortable with it. But I stand corrected.
You think so. And I think there are examples of teachers and librarians that love fantasy and they will go out on a limb for it and be excited about it. But it's kind of like the overall trends or trendsetters or people who are the big mouths, the people whose opinions really matter will often enough be less inclined to embrace fantasy. There's like one more barrier up there in place, I think. It's harder for them to get over that barrier.
I find this really fascinating. Do you think like the Harry Potter effect made that more so or less so?
Well, the thing about Harry Potter, I mean, Harry Potter has been a huge boon to authors like me and probably you guys too, because it opened up the shelves for books like ours completely. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no question in my mind, there's no question about that. But Harry Potter takes place in our world. So you've got familiarity where, you know, you have to start out in that little room under the stairs and go to platform, whatever it is, 9 1/2, 9 3/4, whatever it is.
Not 13.
Get to the, you know, there's still a muggle world out there and we live in the muggle world. And as long as we have that to stand on, the reader knows, you know, has that comfortableness, the comfort before launching into the fantasy. Whereas if you start in a secondary world, I mean, if you look back at the first chapter of The Magic Thief, one of the reasons I think it's so, you know, there's so much detail and sensory detail and metaphor in that first chapter is because it has to help the reader get into that fantasy world initially from the very start, without any grounding, in our world, except that in the sense that it's like a, you know, quasi-Victorian Dickensian world,
right.
But, other than that, you know, it's a big jump for a reader to have to take, especially readers that are possibly less flexible than kid readers.
This is really interesting because I write secondary world. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, I'd slightly younger audience, but I guess I never really thought of it this. I mean, I've thought about the fact that it's not connected to our world per se. It doesn't have that introduction. You're not going through the wardrobe, mm-hmm. right? But I guess my solution to it was I have a very specific narrative voice speaking directly to the reader to kind of lead them along by the hand.
Mm-hmm.
But I never thought of it this way from the perspective of the reader thinking it was, or from the librarian thinking it was that big of an issue. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think in Canada, our librarians love fantasy. Teachers, I don't think, know how to teach it, so they don't use it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the award, you know, the people that dole out the awards that you want the attention from, they're the ones that, I'm going to kill my career here. They're the ones that, well, we had an author, Tim Wynne Jones, actually, who wrote a great piece for our big literary magazine in Canada called the Quill and Quire. And it was this, sort of poem about how the Governor General Award, you know, the types of winners that win it, and it's, which he's won quite a few times, so he can do that. But it was about, you know, it has to be dark and suicidal and drug-addled and
issues.
And issues. And yes,
yeah.
Because
yeah.
For the award books in Canada, that's what they like. So we almost have, you know, a three-tier system here in Canada.
But that frustrates me a little bit because one of the things I love about fantasy, and maybe you can speak to this too, is how you can talk about issues in that more subtle way, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can talk about something really profound, but it doesn't have to be so obvious.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're talking about here is just this general assumption that somehow fantasy cannot be literary because it goes back to Tolkien and people talking about it being escapist.
Mm,
and if something is escapist and not that gritty, realistic, you know, whatever, that, you know, that's sort of a causal thing, you know, therefore it's not it is not serious literature. And I think, you know, Tolkien dispelled that escapism myth really well, in my opinion. But I think that there's a lot of vestigial feeling about that. Like, in general, it's not just in middle grade, but all fantasy in general can't be literary. Because it's not real.
Yeah.
So,
Let me ask you a question, because one of the things that is neat about the Magic Thief is, I don't know what I tend to call the bonuses or the extras or the hidden gems, and there's a lot of riddles and codes and things in here. For me, that's great because I teach a lot of riddles and codes and writing with invisible ink and things like that. How much is that a part of your process of writing the book? Is that something that is an add-on at the end that you worked with your editor and thought you could include that? Or is that an integral part of it from the beginning? Is that how you get ideas?
Oh, no, it has nothing to do with the process. It was all post-process, all the extras that are in the book.
Even the riddles?
They're the codes.
The codes.
Yeah. The codes, yeah, I put those in at the end. And I can't remember... I'm sure it was my idea to do it. Like, notes at the end of each of a lot of Nevery's journal entries.
Yeah, there's little.
So there are the codes, there are little notes, and then there's the key in the back of the book. So people can go and translate. And I'm sure I got that from Tolkien, because Tolkien, as a creator of secondary worlds, created languages for his various
entire languages.
People, and he also created writing systems. And actually, when I was writing The Magic Thief, I was teaching at the University of Iowa. I was teaching an honors seminar on J.R.R. Tolkien. So I'm sure, like, the languages were on my mind at that time. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, it'd be so cool if I could create a little writing system for this magic city. And actually, if you look at the key...
Mm-hmm.
The G in my writing system is the Gandalf G. It's the same G that Tolkien uses. It's my little, tiny little homage.
Okay.
So, yeah, but that all came in. It wasn't part of the composing process. It really didn't come in until the very end. And I think it was my editor's. She was saying, well, we want to put some extras in the back of the book, like, you know, a glossary of the people and a glossary of the names. And I was like, well, let's put in recipes, because that would be cool.
That is cool, actually. My students really enjoy that.
Yeah. and then the putting in the runes, too, I thought would be really cool, the writing system. Because I know, like, I remember as a kid loving secret codes and all that stuff. And I thought it would be right in the zone for your, you know, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th graders. They love that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, Tolkien, you know, I found that, like, he was an illustrator as well, right? And it seems so much, the more I explore his process, it seems so much that he, like, I find it so interesting. You can see pages of his manuscript where he's almost, like, drawn or doodled. And I find that really interesting, how fantasy authors build their worlds. So
yeah.
I guess that's where I was, you know, I'm just trying to get inside your brain.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, with Tolkien, if you go back and look at The Lord of the Rings, it is a three-dimensional world. Like, there's no question to me that Tolkien had in his mind, as he was working in Middle-earth, a three-dimensional map of this world. And the hobbits are always going up to a high place to look at the landscape. So, and Tolkien knew where everything was. And so it doesn't surprise me to hear that in his composing process, he was also creating landscape and having, like, visually that kind of thing, because his world is so real and has so much depth and detail and verisimilitude. I mean, you know how long it's going to take you to get from one point to the other, you know,
yes,
in any chart of Middle Earth. My process is not like that, but of course my world is not anything like Middle Earth either with the kind of details. What's up?
Do you draw a lot of maps at all?
No, I'm not at all an illustrator, or I have no artistic talent at all.
Neither does James, but he draws a lot for his process.
I used to tell my students that the only thing I could draw artistically were stick men. And then with Diary of a Wimpy Kid being so successful, now my students say to me, well, it worked for Jeff Kinney.
Yeah, right. True, that's true. I hadn't thought of that.
He draws
but I'm with the stick
darn good stick man, though.
Yeah. I think we've got our show.
Oh, we got to ask her one official question.
We have an official question that we always ask everybody.
Okay.
So get ready.
Yeah. You know that question that authors dread, the what inspires you question. We're not going to ask you that.
You're not going to ask me that.
No, we are not.
No.
Okay. Our question is, what does not inspire you?
What does not inspire me?
Yeah.
The big thing that does not inspire me is, despite the fact that I'm writing a fantasy that lots of Harry Potter fans will hopefully like, trends do not inspire me. I do not want to write to trend. If the publishing world is saying, oh my gosh, dystopian is really hot, or supernatural young adult is romance is really hot, that is not going to inspire me at all. And I'm going to run away from it probably. Winterling is a book that takes up a lot of fairy lore. And I know that fairy stories are kind of hot right now. And so on purpose, the word fairy does not appear anywhere in the book. Because I'm like, no, I don't want to be having anything to do with the trends or anything.
And your publisher let you get away with that?
Yeah, I'm really curious to see how marketing is going to deal with that. Because it is a fairy story with no fairies in it. Well, I mean, they are. They don't see themselves as fairies. They are just people. I'll be interested to see how they manage that.
We're going to have to check back with you in January when your new book, Fairy World, comes out. And they've changed the title.
Winter Fairy.
And, Winter Fairy.
It'll be so.
I like what you say about the trend thing. When I wrote my first book, Rancor, when it came out, it was, you know, werewolf, vampire, love story. But it was 8 months before Twilight.
Bad timing.
Well, great timing. I was before the trend. Nobody can say I copied it. And then Twilight hit it big, and everybody wanted to read mine, too.
That's good. See, though, okay, good timing.
Yes.
Because I get a lot of some readers who compare my books to the Harry Potter books and say, well, this is just a ripoff of Harry Potter, which in my mind, it totally isn't. I actually have not read the Harry Potter books. Although
you heard it here first, people.
Yeah. I mean, it's a deep, dark secret. But no, I haven't read them. And though, you know, I totally respect what Rowling has done. But they're both books that use the same, that draw on the same fantasy tropes. And so I get a lot of crap about it.
Well, so, you know, the uneducated, not even uneducated, but like kids don't necessarily know, right? I mean, that, like I've had students tell me, even when they read my books, they're like, oh, you stole that creature from Harry Potter. I'm like, Rowling did not invent the griffin or whatever, you know?
Rowling did not invent the gray-bearded wizard. You know, if you look at Gandalf and Merlin and, you know, Dumbledore and Every, they're all drawing on the same sort of wise old man source. Right?
So you have to take that comment with a bit of a grain of salt. So,
yeah. But, you know, I think in general, kids don't care. They just want another book, you know, that's going to get them excited and read everything. So.
So I'm James.
I'm Lee.
And you're listening to
Two Authors Live.